Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We'll be here for the next hour talking about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have a special guest today. Chuck McClung is going to join us. He has joined us. And Chuck not only used to work here at the nursery at one time, he's also a local author. He's published a couple of books. One of them, the first one was on how orchids rebloom. And the second one, which came out just last summer, was strawberries are not a fruit. So Chuck, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to come in and talk
great,
to us.
Great.
We've got some interesting stuff to talk about. Before we came on the air, you were saying that first of all, to start off with, you're one of the few, if not the only person that I know in this business that has not only a degree, but an advanced degree in a botanical background. You have a master's degree in botany. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Which is unusual. I mean, we in this business, when you find people that have a true formal education, it's usually in horticulture. And horticulture and botany are two completely different.
Very separate.
Very, very separate disciplines. And I happen to know that because I've only taken one plant-related class in my entire life, a formal class, and that I took an undergraduate class in botany at San Diego State way back in the day. And it is two completely different disciplines. And typically in this business, in the nursery business, you'll find some people that have degrees in horticulture, but most of the people basically just got into it kind of as a on the side.
That's a passion, I think, for a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the business. My dad grew up in the business. My grandfather was a farmer. So we really never had any formal education. But where did you get your degree from? It was up north, was it not?
Yeah, my master's degree is from Washington State University. And my undergraduate's from the University of Illinois at Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And I had worked for, Oregon State University doing research, the University of Montana. And it was during those years that I realized that I liked working with plants and people a lot more than I like working with plants and politicians. That's how I got out of it.
I could see that.
Yeah.
So. I could see that. Your first book that you wrote, How Orchids Rebloom, what prompted you to write that?
Yeah, good question. So many years I lived in the Pacific Northwest after I got out of college, and I decided, well, I really like working with people. So I worked at a very large independent garden center, a lot like Walter Anderson Nursery that was began by the owner's father, very similar. And we're doing a class one time in the fall called How to Winter Over Your Geraniums, Fuchsias, and Begonia Baskets, something like that.
Yeah, something that we have to deal with here on a pretty regular basis.
Well, that's why I moved here, so we don't have to do that kind of thing. But to start the class, I'd ask people, where'd you hear about it? And I asked this woman in the front row, and she raised her hand and said, well, I drove from like 38 miles away. And what I did is I put into the computer, how do I overwinter my fuchsia basket? And this class came up, and this was in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And like in that moment, like light bulbs and dollar signs went off in my head. And I thought, why don't we just call our classes what people want to know? And coming up was the class on orchids. And I said, why don't we just call it How Orchids Rebloom? And like 80 people showed up. And after having done that class for several years, people said, well, you should write a book about it, but write it the way you say it. Don't write it the way it's in books. So that was kind of the prompting for that. And it took many years. It was just something I worked on slowly, probably for about 7-8 years mm-hmm. to finish that. So that's where it came from, because of one class. But that's probably the class I've done the most over the last 20 years is How Orchids Rebloom.
And this covers a wide variety of orchids. There's a lot of different orchids are actually one of the largest plant families
yeah.
in the mm-hmm. world.
Right.
So there's epiphytic orchids, there's terrestrial orchids.
Right.
And having sat through his class many times, because he's taught it here multiple yeah, times. The 10 different groups, right, of orchids that you speak to in the book.
Yeah. And the fourth chapter I call the top 10 groups of orchids. And I find that like at nurseries, box stores and that, you can take any orchid that's for sale and put it into one of 10 groups. Now, if you go to the orchid show in Balboa Park, that's totally different. Mm-hmm. But when you come in here to Walter Anderson Nursery, any orchid you see is going to be in one of these 10 groups. And yeah, they're all different because orchids as a group are as diverse as plants. There are orchids that live in the Arctic Circle. There's a species of orchid that lives entirely underground in Australia. There are orchids that live everywhere and they're just different. Mm-hmm. And you just have to know how they're different. And even on the book, you know, I tell people, you don't have to buy the book. The secret to getting orchids to rebloom is right on the back of the book. And there's three things you need to have. You have to know what kind of orchid you have. Then from that, you can find out what its native habitat is like. And if you reproduce the native habitat for your orchid, it is guaranteed to rebloom because that's the way nature works.
I was going to say, that's one of the keys that you would deal with at the botanical garden and the zoo and the wild animal park, I'm sure the same way, is you're trying to reproduce locally what their native right, habitat
right,
is.
Right.
And once you get that down, then
you're
not only
right?
the plants are not only going to grow, but they're going to thrive and they are going to reproduce like they do in the wild.
Which is why we could not, people would always ask us, can you grow those really cool blue poppies at the botanic garden? No, because they grow at 10,000 feet in the Himalayas and we don't have the ability to recreate those conditions.
I was talking about in one of the previous shows, the Tillandsia imperialis. Mm-hmm. Beautiful plant. It'll grow and flower down here, but it won't live down here because we're way below 10,000 feet and they need that high cold air. Mm-hmm. And it's really surprising to see a plant like that that grows in that type of condition because you wouldn't think so. It looks like a tropical plant, mm-hmm. but it's not.
Yeah.
As far as orchids are concerned, what would you say are the, if somebody was going to start out and they want something that's going to be easy to grow and rebloom on a pretty regular basis, what do you think your top few are?
Right. For most people, when they're talking about their orchids, they're often thinking of something as a house plant. Now, not everybody, and there are many orchids you could definitely keep outside, but if you're thinking about having an orchid as a house plant, the Phalaenopsis orchid is the way to go. Mm-hmm. For various reasons, just because one flower could last 4 or 5 months. The other thing is the light level it requires is, you know, anybody's got a spot in their home for that. And the temperature requirements for it is a lot like the interior of a home. And often when I do these gardening classes, I'm talking about to people that the goal of gardening for anything that you do, like, you know, you've heard these quantum physicists that want to come up with that one equation that solves everything in the whole universe.
The unified theory.
Yeah, right. So I was thinking, well, would there be something like that for gardening? And then years ago, I thought, well, there is. And it's the following statement, like the goal of gardening for anything that you do is simply to reproduce the native habitat for your plant to get the desired growth habit. And it turns out that the interior of your home is a lot like the native habitat of a Phalaenopsis orchid. You know, like lower indirect light, a low level, low elevation in, you know, Southeast Asia, which how we keep our homes, room temperature mm-hmm. is pretty good for a Phalaenopsis orchid. Another orchid that is great is a house plant that does, you know, very reliably reblooms. You have some here right now are the Paphiopedilums, the lady slipper mm-hmm. orchids. They like a little cooler, but in terms of like an easy to rebloom house plant orchid, those are excellent. And you have some nice ones in right now with the super dark burgundy flowers.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite orchid families are the Paphiopedilums, especially the species orchids. Mm-hmm. And that they are absolutely spectacular.
They catch your eyes when you walk in.
Yeah.
Zygopetalums are one of my favorite indoor orchids too. I get them to bloom 2 and 3 times a year.
Yeah.
And they're super fragrant.
Incredibly
gorgeous fragrant. Plants.
Yeah, that is a really nice one. But you might speak to this. One of the theories that I had seen too for getting Phalaenopsis to rebloom, I've talked to people that have had trouble getting them to rebloom, but one of the tips that I saw a while back that seems to work is they like a cold shock, and not a they don't like to freeze, but they like to have a temperature drop. Whereas if you're growing it inside and it's out of bloom and you want to try to kickstart it, move it outside onto your patio for about a week, same kind of light conditions and everything. You don't want to sunburn it or anything like that. But that temperature drop where it drops down into the 60s at night for a little while, and then you bring it back into the warm temperature again, can sometimes kickstart them into flowering. Have you come across that at all?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's something I even say in the book that, you know, I haven't traveled all over the world, but as far as I can see, it's anywhere on the planet cooler at night than during the day.
Yes. Yeah, that's a given.
Can you agree with that?
It's that sun, right? It's the sun that does that?
That's that bright thing in the sky.
Okay, got it. Right. All right.
So, but yeah, for any plant, that's important. For some plants more than others. And that's why it's really difficult to, say, get a Cymbidium orchid to rebloom as a house plant. There's just simply not enough light, and it thinks it's summer all the time, so it grows leaves. But yeah, for any orchid, it's good to have a drop in temperature of 10 to 15 degrees at night. And for a lot of people, just having it near a window that's open is sufficient. But if that's not the case, like what I found, for people to have their Phalaenopsis orchids outside, and for many parts of San Diego County, it's too cold to have Phalaenopsis orchids outdoors all year long. But if you do have them outdoors, as long as you can, they almost always initiate spikes in October, November, and early December. Like that's very reliable. But you're right. If you find it has not rebloomed, well, first of all, it may have nothing to do with the temperature. There's a lot of other reasons orchids, you know, don't rebloom. Yeah. And that's one of the chapters in the book, is the top five reasons that orchids fail to rebloom. And temperature is one of them. So yeah. If you're one of those people, you work a lot in the winter, you come home at the end of work and you turn your heater up, that might confuse your Phalaenopsis orchid.
I could see that. Yeah. One other trick with Phalaenopsis that a lot of people don't realize is once the flowers fade, if you go back to the nodule where the last flower was on that stem, if the stem hasn't turned brown and faded, you can cut it back to that point. And a lot of times, more often than not, they will branch and send out another flower spike off the original flower spike.
Right.
And rebloom that way. Then you don't have to wait for the whole cycle to repeat from the base of the plant and move its way up. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. Moving on with the show today, we have a special guest in studio today. We have Karen England from the San Diego Horticultural Society has come in to join us. Karen, thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate it.
And not only from the society, the president of the society.
Yeah.
I want to play Hail to the Chief here.
Yeah, that was an accident. Nobody knows how that happened.
Oh, that's funny. And back when the California Association of Nurserymen had a strong presence here in San Diego, my dad was involved with that, as he was with the Horticultural Society for a long, long time. And when it came time to elect the board, a lot of times they would forget to do it. And so they would just nominate people that weren't at the meeting. And then the next time they showed up, they had
a board position. I think that's how I got
this. That was the week you were gone.
Yeah.
So anyway, Karen, thank you very much for coming in and joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the Horticultural Society, how long it's been around. And
it's been around over 30 years.
That sounds about right.
And it met for the beginning years in Encinitas at the San Diego Botanic Garden in the Ecke building. And there are still charter members from that very first meeting that are members to this day.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. It's wonderful to have that kind of heritage in there. I grew up working across the street at Sunshine Gardens. That's
okay.
My family's business. It was my family's business. It's closed now, but, I was there on and off, mostly off, just to be clear. So if anybody ever listens to this, they'll say, she didn't work for 50 years straight, but I was there all 50 years. But so I was the representative from Sunshine Gardens to the San Diego Hort for the face of it. So I was around at the charter membership time, but I wasn't a charter member.
I know my dad, I can't remember if my dad was a charter member, but I know he was involved with it for a very, very long time.
Yes, very early on, and if not charter.
If not a charter member.
Exactly.
And I vaguely remember it meeting at the time, it would have been Quail Botanical Gardens,
correct,
now the San Diego Botanical Gardens. But I do remember him going when it when they would meet at the San Diego race place.
Yeah, Satellite Wagering.
Yeah, at the Satellite Wagering Center at Del Mar for many years.
That was kind of the pinnacle of the membership. It was huge at the time.
Well, you had over 1,500 members, I think, wasn't it?
At one point, yes. We're at around 500 now, so that's pretty good having survived COVID, I think.
I would say so.
And an aging membership.
Well, an aging membership. And one of the things that we've talked about on this show on a number of occasions is just the decline of the horticulture industry in San Diego County over the years.
I could walk to so many nurseries when I was a kid on Encinitas Boulevard. I could go up to Stallings. I could go across over to Widener's and
Stubbs, Fuchsia.
Ecky's Quail Gardens Drive, which is still called Quail Gardens Drive. They haven't changed that yet. Didn't go through when I was a kid. It just dead ended before Leucadia Boulevard, and now goes through there on Ecky's properties.
That's right,
right, right.
Mm-hmm. And they would rent out unused land by them to flower growers, to other nurseries. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have a driver's license, but they would send me in a delivery truck up there. We would rent some property from them to get like overflow plants and stuff like that. And I'm driving, you know, probably going to kill everybody because I'm only like 13 or 14 years old.
Oh my God. The agricultural world.
Yeah. They taught me to drive so that I could move employee cars on a busy day so that the employees that were valuable, I wasn't that, could still work with the customers. They wouldn't be made to move their cars to a dirt lot someplace offsite. So that's why I learned to drive. Anyway. Oh,
very interesting.
And Sunshine Gardens, you said, was your family's garden?
My cousins. I'm not an inheriting part of the family. My aunt and uncle and their three kids had Camar Growers, which was a color grower in Encinitas. And Sunshine Gardens started a few years later as a retail arm of that wholesale business.
That's right. It was it was a Campbell and Martin family.
Yes.
Correct.
So
if I'm not correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that is my... my cousin Ron Martin had Sunshine Gardens, and my cousin Dick Campbell had, and his family had Camar Growers. The retail and were run by different brothers.
We used to buy tons of plant material from Camar Growers in the day. Back when probably the majority of our bedding plants were grown in San Diego County. Mm. A lot of the other S&M growers was here.
Yes.
South Bay. There were a lot of Southland growers, unfortunately, just disappeared a couple of years ago. But there were a lot. And actually, Southland developed from Ferrari greenhouses, which the Ferrari family was a dairy farm.
In Mission Valley.
Right. As a matter of fact, the Ferrari farmhouse is still there between Camino de la Reina and Interstate 8. Mm-hmm. You have to look for it, but it's there.
Is it a historic monument? Or
I don't know if it's historic or not. And I actually don't know if the Ferrari family still owns it or not. But yeah, Southland growers evolved from Ferrari growers. The gentleman that used to own Southland growers, Tom Laff, he bought the business from the Ferrari family. He was their sales rep for a number of years.
We have a world now that's so different than what we remember. Mm-hmm. And I feel like our job now is to somehow keep that going for the people that
trying to hold on to it. Getting away from the San Diego history part of it. Sure. Tell us a little bit more about the Horticultural Society and the mission of the Horticultural Society here in San Diego.
We really want to promote appropriate area gardening among our members and our community. And so that's kind of it in a nutshell. Not wanting to, we want firescaping. We want xeriscaping. We want all the things that are appropriate for our area to be uppermost in what we talk about, but we talk about anything that mm-hmm. grows. Mm. And we sometimes talk about the things that died, but anyway, but it encompasses all of San Diego County. So we're a little different than a garden club. I belong to the Vista Garden Club because I live in Vista, but you know, that's specific to my area, where San Diego Hort is specific to our entire county. Mm-hmm. And so we have so many different climates all around our county. With people up in Julian have a different climate, Mediterranean still, but it's different than we have down here at the coast, and mm-hmm. north and south have different climates and everything. So it's having information and presentations, speakers, and all about the plants that grow in our area, native or not, that, and how to grow them effectively.
Are a majority of the members commercial growers or just backyard gardeners?
No, I would say it was half and half back in the heyday, but now it's the commercial growers have gone, and that wing of our membership has gone as well, pretty much. And it's now more hobbyists, some growers, home gardeners. A lot of landscape designers are in our group, and then and landscapers and that sort of thing, more the maintenance and installation and design than growers.
Yeah, one of the hobbyists that I know that was a member for a long, long time, I don't know if he still is or not, I haven't seen him in years, was Bruce Hubbard.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah.
He's still there.
He's still there.
Oh, he had
he's
an unbelievable collection of
stuff.
Shout
out to Bruce.
Yeah, Bruce has cool plants.
He's got some neat, neat stuff.
Yeah,
and I had only been to his house one time, and he used to live over in Del Dios. I don't know if he still does or not.
I don't think he does now.
Yeah, but I did go to his house one time and got to see his collection. It was impressive to
Orchid
say the
guy
least.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got amazing plants.
He had it was amazing. So you get people from, I guess you could say, almost a fanatic collector just a backyard hobbyist.
No, it's really true. We have some people that are members that are speakers and presenters on a certain topic, mm-hmm. but they're members because they're wanting to learn the things that aren't in their lane.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And you yourself, we were talking about this before we went on the air. You specialize in herbs.
Yes.
But you're not an herbalist.
No, I'm not.
You corrected me very quickly when I mentioned that. Why don't you tell us what it is that you actually do?
I will.
Because that's an interesting story.
I'm, so first of all, to define an herbalist is somebody that has studied the human condition and knows anatomy and physiology and all those kinds of things, as well as botany and horticulture and all, and can treat ailments with the correct plant and all. So there's training involved. There's Eastern herbalism and Western herbalism, and I'm not that.
Okay.
So Miracle Max a Western?
You know, I don't know.
Call in Miracle Max and tell us. But
the Princess Bride.
Oh, the Princess Bride, yeah.
Okay, don't call in. But I call myself an herbologist to be able to have some people be able to call me something.
Okay.
And I'm just a fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
I love herbs. I use herbs. I'm on the board of the International Herb Association, and we are the group that picks the herb of the year each year and have done for the last 30 years. Mm. This year, it's chamomile.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's interesting.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Very good one.
And many years ago, it was rose. Even further back in history, it was scented geraniums. And as a member of the board of the International Herb Association, it turned out, I didn't know this at the time when I took the board position, that I got a seat at the table at the horticultural committee that picks the herb of the year in 5-year blocks. And we just did that. Mm. And I have breaking news for you.
This just in.
This just in.
Paper. Here we go.
Turmeric is the 2026 herb of the year. Flax is 2027. Tulsi and other osmums is 2028. Nasturtium is 2029. And alliums et al. 2030.
Wow.
Wow.
I know.
Very interesting.
Work is done for the next 5 years.
Yeah. Where is it's the International
Herb Association.
Where is that based?
All over. We're not like the Herb Society of America. I'm also a member of that, but I'm not on any committees or boards with that.
Okay.
But they have a home base in somewhere.
Okay.
And the International Herb Association is the treasurer's based out of Florida. So we have a post office box and a bank account in there, but we're all over mostly the United States, even though we're international, and Canada, but we have Australia and Ireland and England.
So mostly at large then.
Yeah. All at large. Exactly.
I have a question. How is an herb selected to be
so
the
glad you
one
asked.
Of the year?
It's like I prompted you and I didn't.
No, you did not.
So what is an herb? An herb is a useful plant, useful for cooking, crafting, or medicine. So that's the definition that we go by. The Herb Society of America says that an herb is a plant of use or delight. So they make it a little easier. But for us, it's cooking, crafting, or medicine, and an herb to be nominated has to be useful in at least two of the three categories. So foxglove, digitalis, berberea will never be herb of the year, even though it's a herb, because it's not culinary and it's not crafting, but it's definitely medicinal.
It is medicinal.
Definitely medicinal.
Yeah. So
interesting.
That's how.
But it is an herb of delight or a plant of delight.
It is.
I like your definition better, because that I think is the traditional understanding of what an herb is.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But maybe digitalis needs a better lobbying group.
Well, I would think heart doctors would be their group of lobbyists. So, but anyway, it's a very important herb, but it'll never be herb of the year because it's not two of the three categories. And then there are so many herbs that are trifectas that are useful in all of the categories. I'm looking at this upcoming list and I look at flax.
That surprises me. I wouldn't have thought.
I wouldn't have thought
of flax as an herb myself, but
okay.
I guess
well, that's why we
is.
Have this program. I'm so glad you said that. Gosh.
Another prompt.
And I didn't even do it on purpose. Flax, you might have had flax seed in your morning bread or on your cereal. You might take flaxseed oil as a supplement. So right there, it's culinary and it's medicinal in that regard, but it's a linen. I'm not wearing linen today, but the last time I gave this talk, I was wearing linen and linen comes from the flax plant. And
well, I guess that could be the crafting then.
Exactly where I'm going with that.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
It's a trifecta.
So it's a trifecta.
It's a trifecta.
And it is a pretty plant too. The flowers are quite lovely.
They are. Yep. No, they really are.
They are. I know. Yeah. I've grown it in large quantities and it's quite pretty.
I don't.
Then I'll go out and eat the seeds. I'll take the little seeds and crush them in my hands, blow away all the seed, the husk and chow down on a bunch of seeds.
I don't think I've ever done that. Oh, I guess I'm missing that.
You don't eat too close to the ground, Ken. I know that.
Well, you can work that into your upcoming schedule.
I can work on that.
I'm sure I was looking at the seed packets before I came here to talk with you guys. And I think I saw flax on the seeds.
I'll have to take a look for that when I go down there.
Grab a packet before you go.
Okay. And you select these several years out.
Yes. We publish a book each year on a monograph on the herb of that year.
Wow.
And I'm a contributor to the books.
Wow. So that whole book is on chamomile?
Yes.
Wow.
This
whole
book is on rosemary.
Holy moly.
Rosemary. No, rose. Roses.
Wow.
And this booklet, we grew from booklets to books. This whole booklet is scented geranium.
I love scented geranium.
Yes.
They do not get enough press.
Oh, they do for me. I have a cookbook of them.
Oh, wow.
Scented geranium yums.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah. Thank you. It's a booklet. It's not nothing. It's a PDF. People could email me if they wanted it.
Wow.
Find me somewhere.
Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. In studio with us today, we have a special guest. We have Greg Opkenorth, who is the head grower and production manager for Grub and Nadler Nursery here in San Diego. Actually, in Rainbow, I got the correct term.
Right, technically Fallbrook, yes.
Technically.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming in, Greg. We really appreciate it. Give us a little bit of background about Grub and Nadler, if you would.
So Grub and Nadler was started in 03 by two people, Flora Grub and Saul Nadler. And they started with a retail garden center in San Francisco, Flora Grub Gardens. And then in 05, they needed more plant material and more plant material that they were looking for. So they purchased a nursery in Rainbow, in Fallbrook, in Rainbow Valley, called East West Trees. That name was changed about 6 years ago to Grub and Nadler Nurseries. Most recently, the company purchased Marina Del Rey Garden Center also in 2023. Yes.
Okay. I've known Tom for decades.
Yeah.
Did he retire then?
He did. He retired.
Well, good for him. I aspire to do that.
Right.
Someday.
He retired, sold the nursery to Grub and Nadler.
Well, good.
To Flora Grub and Saul Nadler. And so, you know, last 2 years, we've taken over that garden center and made it another Flora Grub Gardens.
Well, good. It's in good hands.
It is.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. That's one thing that I had not heard come through the Coconut Telegraph yet. So congratulations to Tom on a great career. He had a very good run of it. So.
Yeah, super nice garden center. It's a big garden center.
Yeah,
it's about 2 acres.
Great nursery.
It's quite large. It's in a good location. It's a nice operation.
Yeah, he used to sell a lot of pottery out there.
Yeah, I personally wasn't totally familiar with exactly what he was doing. But
what are the key plants that you guys grow at the Rainbow facility?
I say we grow what we like to call, California appropriate plants. Plants for the West Coast. So we specialize in a few things. One thing that we specialize in is Protea family. So Proteaceae, right? In containers, being sold to independent garden centers so that, gardeners can be planting those and getting them into their gardens. A lot of great plants included in that group, the Proteas, beautiful flowers, right? Particularly the leucospermums or the pincushions. You have your regular Proteas. One of my favorites is grevilleas.
Oh yeah.
You talk about your bees and plants that bees really love. Grevilleas certainly are one of those. The leucodendrons, Safari Sunset, Goldstrike, those have become very, very much mainstream landscaping plants and very popular plants for the gardens. Other really interesting plants. Banksias.
Oh, Banksias. They're so cool.
Super interesting group of plants, right? Hakea, not well known, but another really great group of plants. So, Isopogon. So there's some interesting plants in that group. So we do a lot of those. We do a very large range of, succulents in a lot of different sizes. We also specialize in palms. We do a good number of palms, which is, part of the history of the company. As well as just a host of other interesting and, in-demand plants.
It's interesting. 40 years ago, the only grevilla that was on the market was Grevilla robusta.
Right.
But that was it.
Right.
And then the ground cover one came out. Was it Mount Tamberitha?
Mount Tamberitha.
Mm-hmm. I think that was the first grevilla that I remember seeing. Besides Grevilla robusta,
Coastal Gem.
Coastal Gem, the other slow one,
short one,
And the grevilleas, start talking about some of these different varieties. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things, I think, is that all the different forms come in.
Yeah.
A lot of them are not really hard plants to grow, but you have everything from ground covers to, mounding, round growing type shrubs,
spider flowered, toothbrush flowered. They're all over
the place, right? So, you get into some bigger plants as well. You know, the one that's been around for a long time is Moonlight, great plant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There are several in that class that I call large shrubs or small trees. So, you know, a lot of different flower colors. Just a very interesting group of plants.
As you were going through them with your enthusiasm, I was just picturing John over here because he teaches a Proteaceae class once a year for us.
Nice.
And as you were listing, you know, the Leucodendron, Leucospermum, Protea, Grevillea, as you were going through, I just pictured him standing up there going through them with the same enthusiasm.
That's probably my favorite plant group, all the Proteaceae. They're just so gorgeous and really pretty easy to grow. I mean, and the payback you get with the blossoms and things is hard to beat.
It is hard to beat. You know, and you know, you talk about, you know, the care, it's a little bit different on a couple of points that I think are important to mention. One is you don't want to be feeding these things with phosphorus.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So fertilizer with phosphorus is a no-no. That's one thing you do not want to do. So, you know, we use a fertilizer that's, you know, like an 18-0-15, just as an example.
You get that from Target Specialties?
We do.
Yeah.
It's actually a Protea special that was developed by Plant Marvel Company out of Michigan that, you know, worked with a group of growers here in San Diego County to really develop this fertilizer so that we have a good fertilizer for this family of plants.
In Michigan, where they grow lots and lots of Protea. Yeah.
Right. Interesting, right? Apparently they do grow some pretty innovative,
I guess,
fertilizer manufacturer.
Well, this is one of the bones of contention for me with a lot of my friends that are horticulturists is they'll say, don't ever fertilize Protea. Just put them in the ground, let them go. And I always rebut with, but the growers are using fertilizer. Why would I not use fertilizer? And so, but yes, no phosphorus. But I find as soon, because now we're doing big landscape installations, within typically about 3 months, they already begin to get chlorotic. They'll already begin to yellow up. If you don't treat that, you'll begin to get what I call chlorotic burn. You know, they'll just turn black on the ends. And so I start to give them iron sulfate and trying to bring that pH down, give them available iron. And then I typically would feed with cottonseed meal or alfalfa meal to keep the phosphorus low. But yes, they need food, you know.
Right. And I agree with you. And you know, oftentimes I've heard, you know, in working with this class of plants, where people sometimes say, well, you know, they get to a certain size or I've had them for a certain amount of time and they just die.
Right.
Well, one of the things that I often wonder is, well, is that just because, you know, at some point we're not getting enough fertility to really keep these things actively growing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is an important point. Also, you know, again, when I talk to customers about this group of plants, I think one of the most important things is well-drained soil.
Mm-hmm.
They really do need well-drained soil so that they're not, you know, sitting in water or, you know, spending time with wet feet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's super important.
Yeah. Once you find the right spot for them, though, like you were mentioning pincushions. I don't think you can get more bang for your buck than you can out of a pincushion.
The amount
of flowers that they produce is staggering.
Right. I don't disagree. And, you know, talking about the flowers and the amount of flowers you get, you know, it's not just the pincushions, like leucodendrons, you know, even just Safari Sunset.
Yeah.
What a great cut flower. A lot of these groups really produce great flowers for cutting in the garden and last a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
they do.
Pincushions, I've always been amazed in my garden at how long the blooming period is as well.
It's extensive.
You know,
if
you work with these varieties, you'll find that there are early blooming ones like Tango. Mm-hmm. Right. You can actually classify them. We've started to do that where we have early blooming, like mid-season, like late season almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can really get a long season of bloom out of pincushions, some of these other varieties.
We need to take a quick break. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman, John Clements, and Adams Bruder. We'll be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. Today we have a special guest in studio. We're happy to have him. And thank you very much to Engineer Todd back in the studio for giving us the referral to Richard Restuccia, who is the author of the book Waterwise Gardening. He's an acclaimed author and nationally recognized expert on sustainable irrigation. is going to talk to us about how to determine precisely how much water your plants really need, taking into account soil type, plant variety, local climate, how often to water, key signs of overwatering and underwatering, simple techniques and tools. And, you know, watering is probably one of the most important things that you need to get a feel for if you're going to be successful either in maintaining your yard or just about any kind of plant related hobby that you might have. So Richard, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for coming in.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I want to say you guys do such a great job in educating this community. Really, really find it to be a privilege to be here.
Well, thank you. We're really happy to have you. And, and like I said, thanks again for Todd for putting us in touch with you.
And Todd's parents are my neighbor.
Okay, that's right. You guys are neighbors. In a previous show we were talking about it. I had started collecting older issues. Well, the Sunset Western Garden book has gone out of print, which is unfortunate because that was our go-to reference book. Still is, but has been for many, many years. And I started going back and collecting older copies of the Sunset Western Garden book. And I noticed as time progressed, more and more things were eliminated from the Sunset Western Garden book that had been there before. And it got to be more of an encyclopedia of gardening, of garden plants than there was as much how-to stuff. And I think it was in the 1954 issue, I found a really interesting article. One of the few articles I'd ever found about, it was about watering. And it was how to water your yard and how to determine how much water you need and how to put that much water where it needs to be. So that sounds very much like what you have done and been working on professionally.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I found is I've been in this industry for almost 30 years now, and watering is tough for people to get. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why is, water's always been plentiful and inexpensive. I think we woke up a few weeks ago in San Diego and heard that the city council is proposing a 62% increase in our water rates over the next 5 years. Yep. After seeing a 30-some percent over the last few years, water is getting expensive. It's typically been something we waste in the garden, mainly because it's been inexpensive. And now I think people are really going to take the time to figure out how much water their plants actually need, because it's going to be financially rewarding for them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I know one of the ones that I dealt with in my yard was a lawn, just watering lawn. And lawns take a certain amount of what I would call a rainfall equivalent to thrive. But a lot of people don't know how to determine, they don't know what that equivalent is, nor do they understand how to determine how your sprinklers work to put that equivalent on the lawn.
So, right. And so then the solution has been, right, this is what we keep on hearing, is take out the lawns.
Exactly.
But I think that is treating the symptom, not the problem.
I mm-hmm. would agree.
Yay. Yeah. Amen.
And if I could just go on to say, please. Right. Yeah. Landscape irrigation, total use in the state of California is about 9%. Mm-hmm. And let's just assume that half of that is for turf. Mm-hmm. If we remove all the turf, replace it with nothing, and remove all the irrigation for that turf, you're only saving 4.5%.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind that people want to take out their turf. I'm not here to say that. What I have an issue with is people think this is going to be the solution to our water woes. Right. And it is not. It is they think it's a simple solution to a big problem, and the problem is much bigger, and the solution is going to be much more complicated than that.
I completely agree with you. And when you do look at the statistics and the small amount, in the big picture, home landscaping and commercial landscaping is a small amount of water use. And that's not to say that because it's so small, you should go out and water your sidewalks and everything and not worry about it. But it's not the panacea, right? It is not going to fix it. You could eliminate it 100% and it's not going to eliminate the problem.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we're offering rebates for $6 a square foot, right? $240,000 an acre. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we've got, it just changed recently within the last 2 years, the amount of pressurized irrigation versus flood irrigation in agriculture here in California. It just crossed over. We still have about 48% of the growers using flood irrigation, mm-hmm. the most inefficient irrigation there is today. And we won't pay them a $1,500 or $2,000 an acre rebate to convert to drip irrigation. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to look at our priorities a little bit here and make some changes.
Well, you know, it's funny. You talk about flood irrigation. I remember this from years and years and years ago, being over in Arizona, one of the hottest places on the planet, and being there in the summertime and driving around and seeing people watering commercial lawns and just their lawns in their yard by flood irrigation in an area that has so little water, to see them watering that way. Because even back then we were conscious of how much water we use here in San Diego, but over there I was just like, who does that? I mean, you would just be vilified in San Diego if you tried flood irrigating your lawn area or any part of your yard. Mm. I mean, it happens every once in a while when the sprinkler line breaks, but I mean, that's a rare occurrence, and it's a different thing.
I actually grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, I was one of those people that had the valve in the corner of your yard, mm-hmm. and you had a time. There was a bulletin at the end of the alley, 3:20 a.m., undo your valve, and then close it back in 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. And in my old neighborhood, which is Central Phoenix, they're still irrigating that way. You can still get that water.
That is amazing.
I see that in some of the citrus in Arizona. But, you know, you started this by saying you've been in this industry for 30 years. What is the industry specifically? And tell us a little about your background, how you got to this point.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So today I'm a senior vice president for Husqvarna Water. It is a new division for Husqvarna. Many people know us for our power tools and chainsaws.
And motorcycles.
Definitely in the 70s, 80s, right? Malcolm Smith, mm-hmm. very popular.
One of my favorite motorcyclists.
Yep. Yeah. Everybody knows Malcolm.
Yeah.
So we've started this now because we really do see a need, right? As one of the most sustainable companies in the world, we're promoting conservation and sustainability all the time. And we see a big need for it here in water. But I grew up in agriculture. I've got a master's degree in agriculture. Started working for Rainbird about 30 years ago. And then I started the first water management division for Valley Crest Companies, the largest landscape contractor in the U.S. at mm-hmm. the time. It's Brightview today. And then moved back into agriculture and now to Husqvarna. Hmm.
And before we came on the air, you and I were just... we were talking about irrigation, and I had mentioned that I had just switched over to the Orbit Beehive controller, and you said Husqvarna just bought Orbit.
Yep, they did about 3 years ago.
Okay.
Now, Husqvarna owns another company called Gardena in Europe.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I'm familiar with
them. They're the largest distributor of landscape tools and irrigation in Europe, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and Orbit was their first venture into North America, and they're going to continue.
Yeah, I think Gardena was the first sprinkler that I ever had that came with a quick disconnect.
Yep.
Yep. They had the plastic quick disconnects, mm-hmm. and they had an oscillating sprinkler. This is a long time ago, but they had an oscillating sprinkler that had a much greater efficiency than the ones that you could get here in the. Get here in the States.
Looked like it should come from IKEA or something. They were very kind of streamlined. Yes.
So yeah. It's very interesting too, right? Gardena is for passionate gardeners. And as soon as I said the name, all three of you shook your head. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Not everybody knows Gardena, but the passionate gardeners do.
We're passionate gardeners.
Yeah. You don't see it over here. You don't see it over here that much, but they do make some very, very good quality products.
Yeah, hello, I'm John, and I'm a plantaholic.
We meet once a month.
So what else can you tell us about how the industry is changing and how things are becoming more efficient?
Yeah, so we talked about solutions for the mm-hmm. water issues we're facing today. One of the biggest solutions today is, you know, technology is really changing. And you mentioned your Beehive Orbit mm-hmm. controller. The technology that you can get in a smart controller today is really incredible, right? The idea that we can check weather conditions, 17 factors of the weather, every hour, and adjust your irrigation schedule on a nightly basis based on these 17 factors, this is a game changer in irrigation right now.
Like I had said, I had just switched over to the Orbit Beehive, which is part of Husqvarna now. And it is a smart controller. And you said that it the controller actually takes into account the weather now and various other factors. So let's talk some more about that.
Yeah, I'd love to. So a couple of things about that controller is it can be programmed in a conventional mode, mm-hmm. or it can be switched to smart mode.
Yeah, I've been using the conventional mode so far. I haven't gotten smart enough to use the smart part yet, but I'm working into it.
But we can help with that. That's okay. The good news, and I know you're smart enough. So, the thing about conventional controllers is this. We were taught for many years in irrigation to program your controller to the hottest month of the year, July, and then make 4 adjustments a year based on the season, right? In fall, you turn it down 25%. In the winter, you might turn it down to 50% or all the way off, and then back on to the spring to about 75 and up to 100 in the summer. And it makes some sense, but if you think about it, that's just 4 adjustments to your controller a year. Now, a smart controller, the Beehive controllers, for example, or our even smarter ET Water controllers will measure the weather on an hourly basis, 17 factors of the weather, and take into account what's happening. And what I mean by what's happening is it overcast? Is it misty today in your area of San Diego? Is it hot? Is it windy? Wind makes one of the biggest differences. So it takes these factors into account and then downloads a new schedule every day. So it will really only water when you need it. Where a conventional controller might water Monday, Wednesday, Friday, doesn't care if it rained Tuesday night, if it was overcast Wednesday, it's putting down the same amount of water. And this is where we learn in the industry, it's one of the biggest factors in the industry why we say people waste about 50% of their landscape irrigation water. Mm-hmm. And that's an issue. And as we said earlier, with prices going up, it's even more of an issue.
Yeah.
Okay, you convinced me, I'm getting one.
So then it even gets better, right? Because with these Beehive controllers, right, you can hook it up to your Wi-Fi and there's no subscription fee or anything. You just mm-hmm. get the water mm-hmm. savings. Now, as you step up into these smarter controllers, we're using AI very well right now. So what a good example of AI would be is these controllers in general measure something called evapotranspiration, ET for short. This is a word that gets people hung up. To simplify that word or understanding of that word, I say it's the reverse of rain, right? Rain is the water coming into the soil. Evapotranspiration is the water that's evaporating out of the soil and what the plant is using to transpire water, right? It plants sweat and use water to pull nutrients up. So in this case, we want to measure the amount of evapotranspiration that occurs on a daily basis, and then replace that water when it's needed. Now, we can measure very easily how much water a cubic foot of soil can hold.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on if it's a clay soil or a sandy soil, it's different.
Yes.
But we do know how much that water, how much that soil can hold. So then if we just simply measure the evapotranspiration to a point of about 50% depletion of water in the soil and fill it back up when it hits that 50% replacement time or that trigger, then you will end up having the most healthy, lush looking landscape you can imagine. And I always say, right, you guys are all familiar with the word hangry. I think my daughter invented it when she was a teenager. But we all know how we perform when we're hangry.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if you could put a device on yourself that would give you the right amount of calories and nutrition every time you got to about 50% of hangry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would really produce. And this is what our plants can do now. And the other thing is it eliminates that overwatering and underwatering because it is doing a real calculation. Now, when I was at Valley Crest, the best water managers we had across the nation might adjust the schedule once a month. This is adjusting a schedule every day. It's just not physically possible for somebody to go out and touch all the controllers that they manage. And even if it's your one controller at your house, you won't take the time to do the calculation, do the measurements, and make the adjustment. So this does this automatically for you. It does it for free on a Beehive controller. It does it for $239 a year on a more professional, larger commercial controller. Mm-hmm. It's really, these controllers pay for themselves in a very short period of time with the water savings. And it's really it's definitely a game changer in the irrigation world.
Well, as I had mentioned on a previous show, when I switched over to the when I switched over to the beehive unit, and that's the only thing that that's changed in my yard. I mean, I've replaced a few sprinkler heads here and there, but the big change was the beehive unit. My latest water,
and then to where you want
to an actual quant month on September 13th. Is that going to be
here in
you will have copies of your,
and I'm looking forward to teaching the,
you will have copies of your book available, and we should have them in,
we're going to get them to sell here as well.
We have available shortly here in the store. So, thank you very much, Richard. We really appreciate you coming in. This has just been,
he's got to come back because there's a lot of water questions.
We're going to bring him back. It's probably one of the biggest issues that we face in an industry right now is making, it's not just conserving water, but getting the right amount of water onto the right plant at the right time. And things have definitely progressed a lot since I've been involved in this business. And it sounds like there's going to be even more coming down the pipeline so to speak.
I see what you did progress. There.
So, yeah, absolutely. And I'm looking forward to teaching the class. Not only will I bring my book to sell, but I will bring all sorts of sprinkler devices so we can look at that and understand how they work, why they work, how to maintain them. So we'll get a little hands-on too. And I think, I think most people can maintain and make additions to the irrigation system when needed. And we'll talk all about that as well. So it'll be a really exciting day.
I think that'll be outstanding. Yeah. You know, speaking of maintenance, that's one of the things that I do from time to time because they do shift. It's not a permanent installation. Just don't spray on the sidewalks or your driveway. I think weed eaters and other things just slowly knock things out of alignment from time to time. And you just got to go out and change it. So anyway, Richard Restitia, author of Waterwise Gardening, thank you very much for coming in, Richard. It's been a great pleasure, and we hope to have you back again at some point in time in the future. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to be back next week with another hour. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.